It makes me feel free.
I do it to save money.
I feel in charge when I'm doing it.
It's a healthy way of life.
Why do you bicycle instead of driving a car?
It's a good way to fit more exercise into my day.
Bicycling is a fun, healthy, economical, and fuel-efficient way to travel. Enjoy the ride. Take your bike. Brought to you by the Franklin Regional Council of Governments and Pioneer Valley Planning Commission, with funding provided by the Federal Highway Administration and Massachusetts Executive Office of Transportation. Come visit enjoytherideby-bike.com.
I'm Rachel Maddow with the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission and the Franklin Regional Council of Governments for Valley Free Radio, reminding you that legally, bicycles are vehicles and bicyclists have the same rights and responsibilities and should observe the same rules as motorists. For more information on bicycle rights and safety, go to www.massbike.org.
Hi, I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder. Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world here on Valley Free Radio or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if they laugh at us. Let them take the bus and need a sickle for us. They can have a Cadillac and T-1-2, but give me my rocket bicycle for two. Thanks for tuning in today. It's Wednesday, July 20th, and I'm here in the studio with a special guest, Eli Damon. Thanks for coming in today, Eli.
Hi, Ruthie. Thanks for inviting me.
We actually have another guest, too, by the name of Andy Singer, in the form of a book he wrote called Why We Drive, The Past, Present, and Future of Automobiles in America. Eli and I are going to talk a bunch about this and how we came to have the car culture that we do, and I'm not sure where the conversation will go. I'm going to start out with a 9 or 10 minute interview with Craig McNeil from TreeCycle. I ran into him on Monday when I was riding around town. So I was doing diaper deliveries and I ran into Craig on Lincoln Ave. And Craig, so you're part of a tree trimming business?
Yeah. I have two other business partners, my wife Marie and Brian, and we own the company called TreeCycle, and we started the company with bicycles, and but the name TreeCycle wasn't for the cycling part of it; it was actually for the cycle of the tree, and really about the connection to the tree to humans and how we rely on trees more than a lot of people maybe realize.
Like just right now, it's a relief to be able to sit in the shade of them to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And also I'm a woodworker and a potter. And so the connection to trees for me really comes into my artwork and working with wood, knowing where it grew and what it came from, fulfills something inside me that like, it just feels so good to know and to climb a tree before you work on it as a piece of wood is really fun too. But what we were talking about earlier about the...
Yeah, so you started the business on bicycles?
Well, we started on a bicycle because that was all we had. We didn't really have any other... We only had enough money to buy one harness and a rope and a handsaw. And actually, we got two handsaws. One of them was twice as big as the other one, so we called it a chainsaw because it was so big. and
where was this?
It was in Boston. Okay. We went to school at Mass Art, and we studied ceramics. And then while we were there, we started working for an arborist and made this connection, you know, through our artwork and the tree work. And then the arborist we were working for went on vacation, and he gave us one of the jobs. We were like, well, we really need some work because we don't have any money. And so he gave us one of the jobs. He said, well, here's a phone number. You can go and get this job. And he, like, just left. And so we were like, okay. So we went and bought a harness and a rope, and we borrowed a friend's tricycle. It was a work bike, a really big trike. And we could put all the brush on the bike and, like, bike it around the corner and like stash it in the woods near the job. And then we went down the street and we kind of just went from one job to another on the bike and bringing our harness and our rope. And then we built our company from that. It's pretty cool. And then, but as we went through it, we realized that we kind of need some of the equipment that makes it so you can actually do a cleanup on the job and to carry a lot of the wood away. So we did buy a truck.
Yeah, it's always a little stressful to like feel like you're going to stash all the branches somewhere.
Yeah, it was definitely not legal at first, probably. But maybe it was also more sustainable because really the best thing is to just let the branches decompose. And that's actually from like Peter Del Tredici. He's the one of the directors of the Arboretum, and he wrote a he's written a lot of articles, but one of them was about, you know, kind of real sustainability with tree work and not chipping everything, but actually just letting it decompose is actually more sustainable because you're not using any fuel and the wood is just turning into soil on its natural way. But then so to expand our business and to kind of keep growing, we looked into buying another truck, and we really didn't like the idea. And our truck is the most expensive thing that we have, and it takes so much fuel, and it takes so much maintenance, and it takes so much taxes and insurance, all just to have a truck. And so what we realized is, like, let's just make a small investment in a bike trailer and just start by just having, you know, two people that can bike to a job. And even if they don't take away all the branches, then we could even come back with the truck later and do the cleanup. But the real idea is just to kind of slowly get ourselves out there doing tree work, but without having to have a truck.
Yeah. Can you tell me, like, about how much the truck costs, like, compare, like, any numbers?
Yeah, well, so for our truck, we got it used, and but brand new, it would be around $65,000 truck. This is a dump truck, and that actually doesn't even include the dump body part of it, which would be... Or actually, no, it would. That would probably include the whole setup. And then, but it's very expensive. And then our chipper is very expensive as well. Ours is actually the smallest and not as big of an investment, but they're around like $10,000 to up to $50,000 for a chipper. And but the insurance is the big thing. Just to have a second driver on the truck, we had to... So our insurance just for the drivers is around $2,500 a year.
And if you just have one driver, that means that one person is
only one person can be
the
driver. Yeah, and they're all
annoying for that person.
That's really hard. A lot of times that's been me, and I really don't like it.
Yeah.
And so we have two drivers, and then, you know, the taxes. I don't know what the taxes are. I think we spent $5,000. I'm not sure exactly what it is per year, but I think maybe $2,000 a year for taxes, or I'm not exactly sure. But it just becomes so, it really becomes stressful when you're trying to build a business and you have all these kind of forces against you.
And there's only a few of you.
Yeah, and there's just three of us, so yeah, exactly.
Overhead.
Yeah. Yeah. So we kind of, We enjoy biking so much. We bicycle to most of our estimates. We bicycle to the truck when we go out and get it, and we're trying to really establish ourselves in New York City and in Boston more. And so, whenever we go there to do work, we really like to set up the truck as a base and then bicycle to jobs in those areas as well. But really, the ultimate goal would not to be going to those places, but just to be here. So if we can get more work here, that's really way better.
Yeah, I mean, how are the economics of that? Like, living, do you all live in Northampton or West?
Yeah, we all live here in Northampton. Our business partner Brian lives in West Hampton, and so the only reason that we go there is because we have jobs there, and so it is worth it to, like, go and travel to work. But it doesn't make any sense. Like, really, we should be working just here at home. So eventually we will. Once we get to that point where we can. But we have to pay our bills.
Yeah.
So it's a terrible thing.
Yeah. So do you, like, spend the night in those places when you have a day job?
Yeah. We have a lot of friends there. Yeah. So it actually becomes really fun. We go and spend 3 or 4 days at a time in those places. We try to cover as many different things as we can. Mm-hmm.
So this all started today because you were showing me the new trailer that you just got. So tell me about this new trailer that you just got.
It's the Surly It's a Surly bike trailer. We got it at Northampton Bike Shop. I think it's called that. Do you know what it's called?
Northampton Bicycles.
Yeah, Northampton Bicycles. And they're really great. They ordered it. Took them a couple days to get it in the mail. And it can carry 300 pounds. It carried all the neighborhood kids. The other night, I rode them around the yard. And we had, I think, 6 kids on there.
Wow.
So they loved it.
Yeah, it looks a lot like the trailers that Pedal People uses.
Yeah. Yeah, and we looked into the... We were actually interested in getting one of each of those trailers, and this
bikes,
one, the
Bikes at Work
trailer. And but we kind of, I guess we got this one, maybe almost an impulse buy. We were at the bike shop and we were like, we got to do it. So we bought it, and it's going to be the start of our time, you know. So maybe people will see us out biking around with it.
With your Arbor.
Yeah, Arbor equipment, yeah, harness and rope.
Yeah. Cool. Great. Yeah. I hope to see you all out there on it. I hope that it all works out.
Yeah, well. That's really cool to talk to you about it too.
And so a new truck was $65,000. How much was a new sturdy heavy duty bike trailer?
This one was around $1,000. Uh-huh. With the hitch. The retail price is around $1,000, but I think we got a little discount, so but yeah, you can talk them down a little bit, maybe over there. Get a good bike trailer for like $700, and there's a lot of different technology going on with bike trailers, so you can jump on the wagon, and check it out and
jump on the wagon.
Yeah.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you.
Yeah. It's so nice talking to you.
That was Craig McNeil from TreeCycle. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Ruthie Woodring, and also here in the studio today with me is Eli Damon.
Hello.
Eli.
Hi. I really like hearing about new businesses that use bicycle transportation. It always makes me feel good to hear about those.
Yeah, did that interview bring up any thoughts?
Oh,
anything else for you?
Yeah, I mean, I came across this video a week ago or something of this. There's this teenager who had his own yard care business, and he got tired of lugging all the tools around, and so he designed and built his own bike trailer. And I was really impressed. I mean, it was made out of lumber, so it must have been heavy as hell. But it was really nice. You know, it looked very sleek.
Cool. Where was this, do you know?
I don't know. I just came across the video. I have no idea where it was.
That's cool. I want to mention also that Craig McNeil mentioned his wife, Marie, who's also part of the yard care business. And Marie is part of Tiny Dance, which is a traveling dance troupe. And they're doing a tour the first week of August and doing free shows. They travel with the stage on the back of a bike trailer or on a bike trailer and on bicycles, and they have a Facebook page, Tiny Dance, I think. But just a few of the places they're going to be performing starting the week of August 6th to the week of August 13th, they'll be doing performances in Amherst, the Town Common, in East Hampton near Tandem Bagel, on the bike path by my house in Florence by Straw Ave. That performance will be on Monday, August 8th from 5 to 6, or at 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. Also at Forbes Library on the 10th. Other places in Florence and Northampton. In Northampton at Pulaski Park on August 12th. And also Kelly Silliman, who is one of the founders, I think, or the founder of Tiny Dance. She's going to be on my radio show in a couple weeks, I think on August 3rd. She'll talk about Tiny Dance a little bit more. And she told me recently that their family's retired their car for the summer. And they're going car free. They're biking everywhere. And they have three or four kids. I think a couple of her daughters hopefully will be in the studio too on the 3rd to talk. So. Eli, I asked you how you wanted to be introduced, and So Eli is a friend of mine, a loyal bike lab goer, avid cyclist, bike commuter, a maker of things. What are some of the things you've made lately, Eli?
What are things I've made? Well, right now I'm do medieval recreation with the Society for Creative Anachronism, and right now I'm making a tunic, which is basically a simple dress, but if you call it a tunic, then men can wear it. it's a little more sophisticated. It fits a little better than the standard one that's the first tunic that everyone learns how to do.
Cool. So you're also a mathematician and a very a philosophical, would you describe yourself as a philosophical thinker or a rational thinker, or you're a very thoughtful person?
I definitely think I'm a philosophical thinker. That was actually when I was in grad school studying math, that's one of the things that convinced me that I really wasn't cut out to go on to do mathematics research, is that I was always having these kind of miscommunications with my professors, because I was always thinking more philosophically than and they were thinking more mathematically. And yeah, so
so I'm going to tie this into biking a little bit, and I've mentioned this book earlier in the show, The Why We Drive by Andy Singer, The Past, Present, and Future of Automobiles in America. This book was published in 2013, and I got a copy from Broadside Books. Actually, I got my first copy earlier in the spring, and then I left it at Bike Breakfast back in May on a bench, thinking maybe someone would enjoy reading it. And I think hopefully someone must have, because it disappeared. So then I went and bought another copy. And if you want to borrow it, just let me know. You can also get it from the library through interlibrary loan. It's got some, like, one page. Okay, this is a small, short book. Whoa, no, actually there's 160 pages now that I look at it. But half of, like, every other page is a cartoon. For example, there's a cartoon that has two panels. One panel depicts a city with cars stacked up, backed up, traffic jam in it, and tall buildings. And the other panel depicts a similar city. The buildings maybe a little bit smaller, but instead of traffic jams, there's people walking and biking, sitting on benches and trees and fresh air. And the caption says, "Divide cities into two sections, driving and non-driving." That cartoon was made back when there is a big debate raging about smoking and non-smoking, and restaurants and things were becoming non-smoking. Anyway, so the back of the book says, "Why does the United States have so many cars and highways? Why do highways produce sprawl? How do our transportation choices impact our politics, neighborhoods, and lifestyles?" These are questions cartoonist Andy Singer answers in, or something, in Why We Drive. So I got this book because I love to bike, if you haven't noticed by the PSAs. And I often wonder why more people don't, and what are the factors that have led us to be where we are. And Andy Singer says that many people believe that America's addiction to automobiles is a cultural problem, and people think that if engineers, elected officials, and the public were better educated about transportation issues, they'd shift the country away from cars and towards public transit and better land use. In reality, he says, our country's automobile addiction has more to do with politics, government agencies, and our tax structure. For nearly two decades, polls, referendums, and increased use show overwhelming public support for better transit and automobile alternatives, alternatives to automobiles. Yet the development of these alternatives has been slow, or in some states, non-existent. To understand why, this book first discusses the problems caused by cars, and then it examines the history and mechanics of highway politics. And finally, it suggests some ways that money can be directed away from highway building and towards non-automotive transportation. When it mentions the tax structure. So I go to these bike ped meetings downtown in Northampton, and many kind of bike advocacy meetings, and there's always people trying to think about how to what changes we can make in the infrastructure to make people feel less afraid or to make people feel safer on bicycles or safer sharing the streets with cars and to get more people on bikes. But really, like, I feel like there's only this one thing, just like one thing that would increase the number of people on bikes so much more than all trying to make all these little changes, which is increase the price of gas or increase the tax on gas. What do you think about that, Eli?
I think that would make a difference, but if I could, I mean, as you know, I teach defensive bicycle driving, and you took my class.
Tell us about Cycling Savvy.
Yeah, so I teach a program called Cycling Savvy, and which is the flagship program of the American Bicycling Education Association, and I'm also the secretary of the board of that organization, and basically. What Cycling Savvy does is it gives you an experience that helps you, start off, building up the knowledge and the skill and the confidence to feel like you can travel by bicycle anywhere you want to, and you don't need to do all the worrying that most people do about exactly. What route they ride on and how, quote, bicycle friendly it is, right? Really, it shows you that the entire road network can, belong to you just like it belongs to everyone else. And if you want to find out more, you can go to cyclingsavvy.org. And we now have some online material. And if you're interested in working with me to put together a class, you can talk to me. But really, I believe that one of the most important things for promoting bicycle transportation is education, is showing people that bicycle how practical and how rewarding bicycle transportation can be if you know how to do it the right way.
What are some things that you've learned through Cycling Savvy? Like, how is learning these tips affected your life as a bicyclist or as a person?
Well, yeah, it's had a huge effect on my life. I have a hereditary eye disorder. So, it's called retinoschisis. And, so I've had mobility problems my whole life. I'm not allowed to drive a car, and for most of my life, it was really hard for me to get around and do the things that I need to do to live kind of a normal life. And then when I discovered these techniques, when I discovered that I could use them to travel by bicycle with the same flexibility that people use when they drive cars. I mean, that changed everything. That opened a whole new world of possibilities. I really became a very different person. It's hard to describe the difference, but I didn't really have any friends before because I wasn't able to do social things. I wasn't able to pursue a lot of things I was interested in, and now I can. And yeah, it's just hard to describe like how transformative it was for me.
Oh, that's remarkable. Are there any, can you be a little more specific about the techniques or tips or riding style that cyclists can use so they can go wherever they need to go on whatever road they need to use to get to their destination?
Yeah, I can, but before I say that, I'd just like to say when I describe these things, they're going to sound really scary to most people. And that's understandable because, they go against what we've been told our whole lives. And that's what the class is for. The class is not just, instructor telling you what to do. It's giving you an experience that really helps you that really helps you get comfortable with using these techniques. So one of them is, you know, cyclists are often feel like they need to stay as close to the edge of the road as they possibly can. Sometimes not even on the road, but really the safest position you can be in most of the time is in the normal, you know, line of traffic. So, you know, in a narrow lane, you might be right in the middle of the lane, or maybe, you know, in some cases, even on the left side of the lane, and that makes you much more predictable because you're doing the same thing as other drivers and you're in the place where their attention is focused.
Why do you think it's so hard, or like in people that you've taught in your classes, why do you think it's so hard for cyclists to move away from the curb and take up more space in the lane and move to a safer position?
Well, I mean, most people have just been told their whole lives that the road is a place for cars and other people don't belong there, and it's, you know, and it's dangerous and, right. And it's hard to overcome that kind of training that, you know, that, I can't think of the right word. And it's also hard because, you know, then other people think there's, you know, other people who have also grew up, you know, being told the same thing, then they think there's something wrong with you and they might get angry at you. And it's really hard to go against that training until you realize what a difference it makes.
Mm-hmm. You're saying how you're safer closer to the middle and because you're predictable, you're visible. Can you be any more specific about what kind of accidents could be prevented, or are there some kind of accidents that you'd be more likely to have if you were in the middle of the road?
So for example, the majority of crashes are the cyclist just hits something, right? Some, you know, debris in the road or a pothole or something. And most of those things are near the edge of the road. Mm-hmm. In addition, most of the crashes that cyclists have with motorists also happen because the cyclist is operating outside of the normal, you know, flow of traffic, right? Which, you know, so for instance, there's the right hook where a motorist passes to the left of a cyclist and then turns right in front of them, or the drive out where a motorist enters the road from a side street and, you know, hits a cyclist as the cyclist is going straight. There's also the buzzing type crashes where a motorist passes, just overtakes you and passes too close, like really uncomfortably close, and sometimes they hit the cyclist too. And I'm sure everyone who's ridden a bicycle on a road has had that experience of being passed really uncomfortably close. And what's going on there is that when you're over near the edge, it's hard to see you. And even when the motorist sees you, you just don't seem relevant. It's not obvious that how much room the motorist needs or how little room is available. It's hard to judge those things while you're traveling at a high speed and you're several hundred or a thousand feet down the road. And so what a cyclist can do is move to a place, is close that gap and make it clear if there's not enough room to share that lane. As you move toward the center of the lane, and now it's really clear from 1,000 feet away, I need to change lanes. There's not enough room. And so then the motorist doesn't end up waiting too long and ending up in a difficult situation, and then they end up buzzing you.
Yeah, actually, the Cycling Savvy website has some really impressive.
What's the
impresionante videos on their website where they show a cyclist riding in traffic. This is in Orlando on like 4-lane roads, and they show how the traffic pattern of motorists passing the cyclists, how they change based on the cyclist's position, and you really see how how motorists respond and how they give the cyclist more space when the cyclist is further towards the middle of the lane, and they tend to pass more safely. It's really cool. If anyone's interested in that stuff, I encourage you to look at the Cycling Savvy. Is that what the website is that has those videos?
Yeah, cyclingsavvy.org.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's definitely my experience, even when it's clear that, someone doesn't like me being there, they still behave more safely around me usually when I'm, I'm there, when I'm in that assertive position.
Yeah. Every now and then I'll be on King Street or Route 9 in Hadley, particularly if it's like rush hour and motorists are impatient, and I'll be in the middle of the right lane, and the motorists, they can't pass me unless there's room in the left lane, on the 4-lane. But sometimes they'll still pass me really close. Like, how do you emotionally or internally or intellectually react to that or process that?
So you're talking about when you're controlling the lane or when you're not controlling
the lane? When you're controlling the lane and you still get passed really closely.
Yeah, I mean, there are some things you just can't control. All you can do is do the best you can. And I get buzzed too sometimes, even when I'm controlling a lane, but my experience overall is a lot better when I'm controlling a lane than when I'm not.
Yeah. Another danger of riding too close to the side of the road is dooring and trying to stay out of the door zone. Actually, did you hear about that cyclist in Cambridge that got killed last month who was riding? They were riding close to parked cars, and then a car door opened, and so they swerved out to avoid the car door and then got run over by a truck behind.
I did hear that, and that's very common in dense urban areas where there's on-street parking. It's a very common type of crash.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's totally 100% preventable by the cyclist, right? All you have to do is just stay out of the door zone, and that mm-hmm. can't happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just also want to add that, like, at risk of feeling like we're blaming the cyclist, just to also add that it may be hard to do that. Like, it's really hard as a cyclist to, like, the pressure that we put on ourselves, feeling like we're in someone else's way. Sometimes it just drives me nuts. It's like, there's no reason for me to feel that, but sometimes I make up what I think the driver behind me is thinking, and it's just not true a lot of the time.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know it's hard, to get over that conditioning. And what was I going to say? I'm sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. Okay, yeah, it is hard to get over that conditioning, but it's really important to do that, and you can do that with the right training.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There. I'm talking with Eli Damon. I'm Ruthie Woodring, and this is Valley Free Radio. We're going to take a little break, and then I might share some more choice things from Why We Drive by Andy Singer. I really haven't shared much from that yet, but there's good stuff in there. I'm going to get to it. Thanks for listening.
The Oblivion Express is on the move. Starting Thursday, August 11th, the Oblivion Express will now be on Thursday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. A great way to start your day with old-school, free-form radio, only on Valley Free Radio. If you want to know when the Oblivion Express is on, you can like the Facebook page, DJ Funkadelic Fern. That's DJ Funkadelic Fern. The Oblivion Express, starting August 11th on Thursday mornings from 6 to 9, found only on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM. Mandolin Orange has been quietly gathering local and faraway fans since their debut album in 2010. The North Carolina duo's music is often wistful and contemplative without being somber and always firmly grounded in the South. Mandolin Orange will be appearing at the Gateway City Arts at Holyoke on Thursday, July 28th. Singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Andrew Marlin and violinist-guitarist Emily Franz draw from wells both old and new, offering up a heady mix of bluegrass, gospel, folk, country, and pop that invokes the earthy timelessness and effortless harmonies of Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, the sweet unpredictability of Nickel Creek, and the rich Gothic Americana of the Civil Wars. Mandolin Orange, Thursday, July 28th, 7:30 p.m. For tickets and information, visit the website signaturesoundspresents.com.
All right, so now I'm going to play a song by Evelyn Perry. It's called The Ballad of Annie Londonderry. This is from a theater piece she did called Spin.
Would you take a dare? Would you take a wager? What would you wear? Would you wear bloomers? Would you leave your home without any money? Would you care if people looked at you funny? Annie Londonderry, Annie Londonderry, Annie Londonderry rode no ordinary. In 1894, a young woman by the name of Annie Londonderry began her journey to become the first woman to ride around the world on a bicycle. She went alone. She left her husband at home with her three children. She was settling a bet between two businessmen, $20,000 to 10, that no woman could beat the record of the only man, one Thomas Stevens, to have cycled around the world some 10 years previous. The terms of the men's wager was this: she must begin her journey penniless, accept no gratuities, earn $5,000 on her journey, collect the signatures of American authorities in every foreign city she rode through to prove where she had been. She had 15 months to complete the ride, and then the prize of $10,000 would be hers. So on a day in June, 1894, packing only her courage, a pearl-handled revolver, and a change of underwear, Annie Londonderry set out from her home in Boston to stick it to the man. Would you take a dare? Would you take a wager? What would you wear? Would you wear bloomers? Would you care to change things? Would you dare to change things? Would you be laughed at? Shrug off the laugh track? Would you ride your bike through the desert without a map? Would you go alone? Annie Londonderry, Annie Londonderry, Annie Londonderry rode no ordinary. On the morning of Annie's departure, a crowd, some 500 strong, gathered in front of the Massachusetts State House to bear witness, to do business. Sponsors, well-wishers, women's rights agitators, suffragists, naysayers, disapprovers, disbelievers, curiosity seekers, family members, and a representative from Pope Bicycle Manufacturers.
One, two, three.
The Columbia
Safety, Safety, Safety
set the standard for speed, strength, and beauty.
The Columbia Safety Bicycle is made with brains and conscience by Pope Manufacturers, biggest and best bicycle manufacturer in the world.
Would you take a dare? Columbia, would you take a wager?
Columbia Manufacturing, that was in Westfield, Massachusetts. My next door neighbor, my neighbor across the street actually used to work for Columbia Bicycle. Manny, I should interview him sometime. So that was the Ballad of Annie Londonderry from Spin by Evelyn Perry. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton. I'm here in the studio with Eli Damon. And yeah, we've and been... Go.
Oh, yeah. And there's a really good coffee table book called Wheels of Change that reminded me of, which is all about you know, the relationship between, you know, the women's liberation and cycling in the late 19th century, you know, a time when, you know, cyclists themselves were breaking a taboo, and then these female cyclists had to break this taboo on top of a taboo. Anyway, it's a good book.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm not sure what happened to Annie Londonderry, but I know that she survived. The song just kind of ends. Maybe next week I'll find the second ballad and see what more about her adventures. Yeah, it's interesting. In Northampton, I feel like the men and women, or like the gender balance in biking, is fairly balanced. But then when I went to Chicago a couple months ago, I just saw so many more men biking than women. And it just, I forgot that that's still a problem. I mean, it is that women need a lot of encouragement to bike, I think. So this Why We Drive by Andy Singer. Here, I'm going to read a couple things. He says, you might ask, why would you want to give up your car? And he says, giving up your car commits you to living in an urban or dense suburban area. This is because only these areas can be regularly negotiated by bicycle, walking, or public transit. Giving up your car commits you to your neighbors and commits you to collective social relationships because you're more dependent on your immediate neighborhood for employment, goods, and services. Giving up your car also commits you to behaving in a more time and energy efficient manner, and it commits you more deeply to public transit and the environment. By giving up your car, you become a better political advocate for transit, for cities, and for your neighborhood, since you gain a more intimate knowledge of how they function. Anything you want to say about that, Eli, before I turn to the next page? Have you found that to be true in your life? Not that you ever gave up a car of it.
Right. I don't know. Go on.
Okay. Okay. So this book was written in 2013. And I'm not sure what year. Oh, I think these statistics are maybe from 2005, 2006. He says, each year the average American drives 13,476 miles and spends over 13 40-hour weeks behind the wheel of a car. That's from the Federal Highway Administration statistics. Studies show all this driving is partly responsible for the exploding rates of obesity. They point to suburbanites' increased need to drive. So giving up your car keeps you in better physical shape and decreases the amount of time you spend moving between destinations.
Yeah, although obviously there's middle ground between doing nothing and totally giving up your car.
Yeah, actually I know people that are getting into electric bikes now, and I want to do a show about electric bikes, and I'm really curious to see if that's how that's helping some people go more car light. Well, like I know some families who have gotten an electric bike instead of a second car.
And I know plenty of people who have a car, but they just don't, they only use it when they have something where a car is like the only thing that'll do what they want to do.
So what Andy Singer just said, giving up your car decreases the amount of time you spend moving between destinations. Okay, well, I'm gonna go on. So he says, because Americans spend a sixth of their income to own and operate cars, not having a car saves you money, over $7,479 per year on average, to pay for gas, oil, maintenance, insurance, depreciation, tolls, tickets, and parking. As the cost of fuel rises, this cost of car ownership will rise as well. Will the cost of fuel ever rise?
I'm sure it will.
So as the late Ivan Illich pointed out back in 1973, this is the Ivan Illich quote, the model American male devotes more than 1,600 hours a year to his car. He sits in it while it goes and while it stands idling. He parks it and searches for it. He earns the money to put down on it and to meet the monthly installments. He works to pay for gasoline, tolls, insurance, taxes, and tickets. He spends 4 of his 16 waking hours on the road or gathering his resources for it. The model American puts in 1,600 hours to get 7,500 miles, less than 5 miles per hour. And Andy Singer says, "Today we drive twice as many miles as we did in 1973, but the cost of car ownership and thus the number of hours we devote to our cars has also doubled. For all our money, time, and effort, we're still moving slower than a bicycle."
Yeah, and there are so many people who have cars because they feel they need it, but they really can't afford it, and they're stretching their, they spend maybe a quarter, a third of their income on transportation. That's just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, it's hard though. Like if you have a family and the kid goes to school at one place and you got to go to work somewhere else, and then we develop these lives that are complex, that are really complicated, and everything's got to go here, there, and somewhere else, and then we're in a rush and there's just not enough time.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's partly a logistical, partly a infrastructure problem, and partly a cultural problem.
Yeah. Kind of what the world expects from you is kind of dysfunctional.
Yeah. There's another great cartoon here that's got a picture of a traffic jam and a man in his car at the wheel on a cell phone, looking really frustrated. And then underneath there is a happy man walking with big strides, and the caption of the man in the traffic jam on the cell phone says, "Successful man." And the caption of the man walking says, "Unsuccessful man."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I really like that calculation of the, the effective average speed of a car, right? And the total, the distance you travel divided by the total amount of time you spend, doing anything related to the car, mm-hmm. right? Because it shows on average, cars are incredibly slow, even though instantaneously they can be very fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious if I did the same breakdown for my bicycle and how much time I spend fixing and fiddling on my bicycle. Like, how would that compare to walking?
Yeah,
it's not so fast after all, actually.
Yeah, well, yeah, you might be right about that.
And then I do have the same, I slip into the same sort of cultural things about trying to do too much and speed, even though I do it all on a bike. It's still I don't have enough time to walk. Right. Same way drivers think they don't have enough time to bike.
Yeah, but again, if you're spending a quarter of your income on your car, well, then that's think of that as a quarter of your work time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so here's a little history from Why We Drive. To see what cars have done to our landscape and look for alternatives, it's instructive to look at pre-automotive cities or pre-automotive city sections. These older pre-car or car-free areas are often popular places to live, like Cathedral Hill or Merriam Park neighborhoods of St. Paul, Minnesota, where the author lives. They're good examples of this. These buildings and much of the neighborhood were built in the late 1800s and early 1900s along an electric streetcar line. By 1900, most U.S. cities had networks of street railways, and cities were planned around them. Buildings were designed to be taller and closer together so that everyone in the neighborhood would be within easy walking distance of the streetcar line. Well, the bike path in Florence used to be a trolley line. And now pre-automotive or car-free areas are huge tourist attractions, like Disney World and other amusement parks, or Venice, or the Casbah, or the old sections of Brussels or London, or the French Quarter of New Orleans, or the North End of Boston. What else? Say something, Eli. I'm looking for another good quote.
I've seen some suggestions of making downtown Northampton a pedestrian only area. Mm-hmm. I live in East Hampton. I think it would be really nice if downtown East Hampton was a pedestrian only area.
Yeah. Okay, so they're talking about streetcar neighborhoods and how they feature pre-automotive 3- and 4-story walk-up apartments along transit corridors with lower density housing on the side streets. In the early days, transit, by its very nature, created dense housing because people had to live within walking distance of the transit line. The general pattern would be a transit line on a larger street that was zoned for denser commercial or mixed-use buildings, then 6 to 10 blocks of slightly lower density residential housing, followed by another transit line. And you can see this transit-oriented style of housing, like those neighborhoods that we just mentioned. They contain 2- to 3-story walk-up apartments and old homes with big front porches. Before cars, you came and went from your house via the front door. Thus, the porch was your interface with your neighbors. And then the automotive suburban tract homes did away with porches. You enter these houses directly from the garage and have limited interaction with people around you. Because of the space required by cars, suburban homes take up more land and are inherently spread further apart. Thus, unlike transit, cars tend to promote low-density, sprawling development and reduced human interaction. When I first started to bike with passion, I think I was probably like 15. I was a junior in high school, and I lived like 8 miles away from school, so I would bike. This was in Tennessee, so I'd bike when I could. It was this 4-lane highway with a big shoulder, and once one of my older sisters, she said. I thought she was going to drive into town for something. She said, I'm going to walk to town. And I was like, you're going to walk 8 miles? And she said, yeah, because I don't want to make any pollution. And I thought, whoa, if she can walk 8 miles, I can bike 8 miles. And it wasn't really till I was 19, till I moved to Chicago, that I started to understand a lot of the ways that car culture, or the ways that driving cars and that set up, it's so much more about air pollution. I mean, it's so much more, it's about so much more than air pollution. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting what you were reading about how cars affect the way we build, the way we build buildings and spaces and how that affects the way we talk to each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, I live in a building where I don't think I've even met half the people in my building. Just cause, well, first of all, I'm pretty shy and it's hard for me to talk to people, but also there's no kind of outdoor shared space other than the parking lot that you can kind of hang out and, you know, and see people. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, kind of really frustrating. Also, just when you're on the roads, you really don't see people. You don't kind of run into people the way I imagine that you did before everyone was in cars.
Yeah, a lot of times when I'm biking, motorists, like friends of mine who are driving, like they wave, they honk, they say hi, Ruthie, and I'm like, sorry, I can't see inside the window. I see nothing but the reflection of the road or the sky. But hi.
Yeah.
Thanks for being friendly.
Yeah. And I mean, even when I'm walking with a friend, it's really hard for us to talk to each other because of all the engine noise.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, so here's something else. Like when I thought about air pollution and car exhaust, I just thought it was the exhaust. But this says that in addition to the soot that comes out of the tailpipes, cars produce tire dust. It's a mixture of petroleum-based rubber and particles that tires and brake discs shed as they wear down. Tire dust can contain asbestos and heavy metals. If you live next to a highway or major boulevard, tire dust and soot are what blackens parked cars, windowsills, and porches. You breathe them, and new research shows that children who grow up near heavily used roads can have permanently reduced lung capacity, putting them at risk for asthma, illness, and premature death as adults.
Yeah, and also about half of the greenhouse gases that a car is responsible for are emitted during manufacturing and distribution and that stuff, that you know, it has nothing, regard whether you, you know, like before you even start driving it.
Like in terms of like electric cars or whatever, however efficient your miles per gallon is still the embodied energy and all of that. Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, so that's why I think that electric cars are kind of a cop out environmentally. I don't think they're that big of a solution to anything.
Yeah. We're gonna have to wrap this up soon. I might do a second edition of this book just because I love it so much, even if I hope other people are interested. But the one thing, so the picture on the front page of this book, I gotta find it inside the book. It's a picture of two men in suits shaking hands and passing a check while a trolley car is ablaze in the background. In terms of how it was intentional how we moved away from public transit. Okay, so this is a picture of... Okay, let me read this. Page 93. The author says, "This is one of my favorite pictures of the 1950s era. It depicts politics at its sleaziest. It was taken in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1954. The man on the right is Fred Osana. He was a former National City Trolley Lines attorney with links to organized crime. In 1949, he was put in charge of Twin Cities Rapid Transit Company. The Twin Cities had an extensive public transit system with 530 miles of track and over 700 transit cars, many of which were built right in Minneapolis. Osana brought in General Motors as a consultant who helped him to finance the conversion of Twin Cities Rapid Transit to GM buses. Osana ripped up the tracks, sold off some of the trolleys to Mexico, and burned the rest. Here he is receiving a check for his handiwork from Twin Cities Rapid Transit Vice President James Towie as the last of the trolley cars burn. 6 years later, both men would be convicted of fraud, conspiracy, and embezzlement." That's just one little sample. Anyway, Democracy Now! Is coming up at 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to Out There Today. And Eli, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I was very tired this week and didn't feel like doing computer work, editing clips and all that. So it's nice to have a live guest. Anything else? No, well, just play this.
Off the Record every Sunday from 7 to 8 p.m. for some of the craziest comedy music from past and present, hosted by DJ Darren.